It's a pleasure to be here. I'm not quite sure whether it's a pleasure to be addressing this particular question, which strikes me as a little bit of a hardball, but I am pleased to be here and to talk on this subject as best I can. And I'm looking forward to the discussion time and to your questions, which I hope will draw out even more important things than I'm going to say to you meanwhile. Well, let's begin because there is actually a lot to talk about, and so I think it's proper we should launch right in. And let's just see if I can make the first slide. There we go. Right. If Israel matters, it matters, of course, to different agents for different reasons. It mattered to Jesus and his disciples, as to all Israelites, because it was the land of promise and the place of God's chosen dwelling. Yet Jesus, as you see here, predicted that God would once again abandon that place of dwelling. It mattered to the Romans because it was always a hot spot of revolt. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force, said Jesus. A serious attempt pictured here, somewhat imaginatively at the bottom, but you see on the upper right a section drawn from Titus's Arch. The Jews made a serious attempt to seize Jerusalem for themselves in AD 66. That, of course, did not end well. Destruction of Jerusalem 4 years later by the army of Vespasian and Titus in fulfillment, Christians have always said, of Jesus' prophecy. In AD 130, when Emperor Hadrian vowed to rebuild Jerusalem from the wreckage, it was rumored that he might do so as a gift, sort of peace offering, as it were, to the Jewish people. But after he came to the city and viewed it, he decided to rebuild it as a Roman city dedicated to Roman gods and to name it after him, after Jupiter and himself. And so you see the coins that he had minted proclaiming that the economy in every sense of the new city would be Roman and dedicated to Roman goods and Roman gods. And, of course, to himself. Simeon Bar Kosava led a fresh rebellion in 132 AD. Whether before or after he heard of Hadrian's plan, I'm not sure. But this redemption that he promised, this beginning of the kingdom of God that was now going to be present in Jerusalem under his leadership, was very short-lived. By 135, he and his followers were all dead, along with Jewish dreams. We're told that Jewish sources include little historical material about this war. Instead, they seem to focus on a debate about whether its leader should be called Bar Kokhba, meaning son of a star, and hailed as Messiah, or Bar Kozeba, son of a liar, whose power and ambition resulted in calamity for his people at the hands of the Romans. I shouldn't think that's actually much of a debate, given the outcome. In 638, sorry, I didn't give you the bottom part of that, but you can see this reference to, depending on how quickly you read, of course, to the question as to how to evaluate Simeon, just as there was a question about how to evaluate Jesus after he was crucified. Now, Jesus was helped rather a lot by the fact that he rose again, but Simeon didn't. This map, which comes from Jordan, shows what the new city built by Hadrian and subsequent builders looked like, although it's a little difficult for most of us to make that out. But in 638, of course, the Roman rule had fizzled out as well, and the Muslims conquered Jerusalem, and new temples were built, not to the gods of Rome, but to Allah. And Al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock, of course, still sit there today. They have rested ever since on the Temple Mount. On Augustine's view, and I'm sorry for a few slides with rather more text than is fair, but you know, those of you who don't find me very helpful can at least amuse yourselves by reading someone more more astute. On Augustine's view, the dispersal of Jewry after the fall of Jerusalem was a permanent sign of Christianity's claim to being an act of God and to being a salvation historical religion, and indeed to the church's claim to have somehow superseded Israel in the blessing of God. And as Paula Fredrickson puts it, perpetual political desuetude, a people forever without their land, is for Augustine both a quotidian reality and an eschatological fact. It's a historical fact with theological meaning. I think, however, that that's a little bit misleading. Some strands of Christianity have pressed that way of reading Augustine, I think, much too far. And so, for example, when Israel does once again, in our time, more or less, become a place for Jews, this, as it begins to happen, is unthinkable to some people, some Christian people, some Catholic people. So there was this strand of thinking that God had done with the Jews, qua Jews, and with Israel, qua Israel, back in 70 AD, when Jesus' prophecy was fulfilled, and nothing should ever change. But I don't think that was Augustine's view myself. He knows, as you can tell if you read the last part of The City of God, for example, about the existing tradition in his day, going back at least to St. Irenaeus, that someday the Jewish temple would be rebuilt. He knows that Jesus was not only a prophet of doom, but a Messiah of promise, that God, who was already present in Jesus' own person, would appear again in his chosen place when Israel was truly ready to receive him. What did Jesus say when he made that prophecy, or just before he made that prophecy? He said this: "You won't see me again until..." Well, Augustine knows all of that, and I trust that you do as well. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit in this next section about millennial visions, and particularly about Zionism. The movement to rebuild a Jewish homeland with all requisite Jewish features is certainly not an explicitly or even perhaps a naturally Augustinian idea, but it is Christian in its origin. It springs from Puritan and Reformed sources in 16th and 17th century England, with luminaries such as John Milton taking an interest in it as well. Notes in various editions of the popular Geneva Bible encouraged this, and the whole idea and the movement itself as a sort of theological slash political movement had gathered quite a bit of steam by the 19th century. Both post-millennialists and evangelical premillennialists factored it into their general eschatological scheme of things, into their political planning as well. And if you want to learn more about that, you could see Don Lewis's book from Oxford back in 2010 that was entitled Origins of Christian Zionism. Lord Shaftesbury, whom you see here, was much influenced by the evangelical premillennialists and became perhaps the most effective proponent of Zionism. It was also he and those who influenced him, the whole movement was sort of spurred on to some extent also by Jewish converts to Christianity, it must be said. The Puritans who came here, and the Baptists too for that matter, brought the idea with them. And there were, in that period, of course, romantic, nationalistic ideals in play as well. Not to mention some strong anti-Catholic sentiments, which were developed into theories about God blessing the nations that were good to the Jews and cursing the nations that weren't. Recent advances in the United Kingdom, for example, were put down by these people to the fact that they had begun changing their attitude towards Jews. Now, a lot of people hadn't and still haven't, but some of them had. And Spain, on the other hand, its influence was waning. Spain was thought of as a very anti-Jewish kind of people and nation. And so these kinds of things were all being bandied about, not just in theological circles, but in political circles. Well, Shaftesbury and his colleagues, as you probably know, published this, at their own expense, I believe, Memorandum to Protestant Monarchs of Europe for the Restoration of the Jews to Palestine in 1841, marking the beginnings of a serious political effort that would eventually generate the Balfour Declaration in 1917, indicating Britain's official support for the idea. An historical and theological footnote here. Jerry McDermott, in his book, Israel Matters, suggests that all of this was not beholden to the dispensationalist scheme of J.N. Darby and friends. How many people here have heard of J.N. Darby? Only one. Well, that's good. Two. sorry. So I don't want to. You can explain it to them all afterwards, right? I don't want to be too distracted with this, but the dispensationalist scheme of things, which involves also the church being raptured before the Great Tribulation and lifted out, you know, sort of airlift. I almost needed that getting here. The plane broke down And so there I was sitting in the airport in Montreal wondering, am I going to get here? Are you all going to be sitting here looking at an empty podium? But fortunately, Air Canada had a spare plane, and here we are. Anyways, that whole dispensationalist premillennialism that was just coming on the scene at this time through these sort of quasi-prophetic writings, or at least new theological interpretations of J.N. Darby, has often been thought of as lying at the roots of Christian Zionism. And Jerry McDermott suggests that, in fact, that's not the case, that it was the postmillennialists, the Puritans in particular, who dreamed this, well, not dreamed this stuff up, but who, you know, who started the ball rolling here. Now, Shaftesbury, in fact... was not a postmillennialist, but a premillennialist, as was his teacher. But anyways, we need to have a little bit of understanding of this millennial concept. Okay, so I'm just going to do my theological thing and explain that to you very quickly. Is that all right? Or do you all understand it already? If you do, that'll save us some time. Here's how the language works. There's basically three types, okay? And the premillennialists think that Jesus is going to return, and when he returns, he's going to set up an earthly kingdom that's going to last a long time, 1,000 years, obviously, symbolic language, although some people take it literally, but... And then there'll be some kind of last revolt, and then the end of the world as we know it. The postmillennialists think that Jesus will not, in fact, return until a kingdom of peace, the kingdom of God, really, has been set up on earth by human cooperation with God. And it's only when that kingdom has appeared and been tried and tested and people have made some decision about that, that the parousia will happen. The amillennialist position is kind of oddly named, really, because nobody's actually an amillennialist. It is Augustine's view that the kingdom of God, where the saints reign, is actually a reference to the church and especially to the saints whose prayers and whose sacrifices secretly rule history during this whole time of turmoil in which we live. So when Christ returns, there's the last judgment and all of that in the new heavens and earth, and there's no intervening millennial kingdom. It's already happened. Right? Fair enough. All right. Well, let's move to a non-theological vision for Zionism. This has as its chief founder Theodor Herzl. He was stirred deeply, as many people were, by the infamous Dreyfus affair in Paris, where Captain Dreyfus was falsely convicted of treason and anti-Semitism sort of was boiling over there. And this drove him to become what I suppose we could call a secular Zionist, and to push very hard for there to be a return of Jews to the Holy Land and possession of the land by Jews. And he's widely regarded as the founder of the State of Israel. Not the founder of the State of Israel, I'm saying the father of the State of Israel, spiritually speaking, because even though he did not live to see it founded, it was in many respects his efforts that made it possible for it to happen. In Der Judenstaat, written in 1896, he laid out the program for reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty in Palestine, the gathering of the exiles, and this not yet achieved by any means, the liberation of Jews from discrimination and persecution. Many establishment or assimilationist-oriented Jews resisted the idea. Some religious Jews charged him with a sort of playing God. But others who had premonitions of what was to come in Europe supported him. And, of course, his vision came to pass. There were then, and there are now, arguments about whether Zionism should be only a political exercise or also a cultural one. Should there be just a Jewish state? I mean, should there be just a state of Jews, or should there be a truly Jewish state? That is a long-standing argument that's not yet settled. Meanwhile, of course, something else burst onto the scene. Hitler's Aryan nationalism and his own twisted millennial vision for a Third Reich that would last 1,000 years. And the Reich, of course, demanded Lebensraum for Germany, but there would be no living space granted to Jews. Another place was designed for them. Those are plans, of course, for the death camp. I think the one at Auschwitz, but I'm not certain of that. And those were being drawn up right from the start. So room was to be made for Jews here at the end of purpose-built railway lines where gas ovens awaited. After the war, the land of Israel opened up its mouth to receive Jews who had escaped the torrent pouring forth from the dragon's mouth. I'm alluding, of course, to Revelation 12. While the dragon turned, in the equally twisted realms of Marxist millennialism to pursue those who confessed Messiah Jesus and kept his commandments. In 1949, Israel was received into the UN against many objections. Hadrian's ban, in other words, was fully overturned. Where is it all going? Nobody seems quite sure. Well, all that that you just heard, I suspect you knew, well, most of it anyways, and that was just a review to set things in historical perspective. I hope you know this too, because we're going to back up all the way to St. Paul and try to recall what he says about the future of Jews in his letter to the Romans, a city, by the way, in which it's some scholars think that more than one whole synagogue converted to Christianity. Paul, by the time he wrote Romans, knew by bitter experience and also by much public debate how great was the opposition to Christianity among Jews, in part because many Jews were converting to Christianity. Anyways, here's his plea to God on behalf of the Jewish people. And you might think of Moses on Mount Sinai after the episode of apostasy that we refer to as the golden calf episode, right? I don't know why we call it a calf, because the whole idea is a virile young bull, right? So the golden bull. And God, of course, is angry with the people, and he's going to wipe them out or abandon them at any rate in the desert. And Moses says, well, look, you know, if you're going to strike their names out of the book of life, you better strike mine too. And he intercedes for Israel. Paul is doing something like that in this plea to God in his prayers, which he recounts and theologizes on in Romans 9 to 11. He also wants, of course, to set the record straight that there's no question of him being against the Jews, his own people. He is very much for them. This also is from Romans 10. And here we might think of Elijah, who at one point got so fed up with the apostasy of the people that he pleaded with God not to take their lives, but to take his. He'd had enough. And then God steps in and makes the case for Israel. And Paul himself is trying to explain in this text, this very important part of the book of Romans, how God is faithful to his people and to his promises and to his own word, and to read history in such a way that he can demonstrate God's faithfulness, which is really what the book of Romans is all about in all of its parts. The remnant to which he refers is... I think the remnant that enters the church, those who are converting to Jesus the Messiah, but on their account, the whole lump remains holy. Those who are receiving the good gifts of God in and through the person of Jesus are those who keep the people of Israel properly alive and qualified for God's favor. Those who are outside the church benefit from this. They remain under God's providential care while they continue to be called by the gospel into the church. Paul's plea here to us is that we not be so wise in our own conceits that we think we can dispense with the Jews and consign them to some kind of perpetual desuetude. But rather that we should labor for their salvation and also for ours. alas, we have been conceited and found ways to harden the Jews, wicked ways to harden the Jews, not the ways God hardened them in through their own sins, but to harden them now through the sins of Christians who have treated them badly. Not always badly, not everywhere badly, but yes, sometimes very badly. And that I say without for a moment conceding that the Holocaust should directly be put down to the church or to Christians. I think that historically just doesn't cut it at all. But one cannot deny that Christians have been complicit in the sufferings of Jews in ways they certainly ought not to have been. God does not approve of that. Augustine would not have approved of it either. Remember that he said, if you were able to dwell long enough on that earlier slide, that they have the mark of Cain on them. God is protecting them. And they're not to be treated that way. Because in the end, as Paul says, and as Augustine knows very well, God is going to complete his work with them and convert many of them to what God has actually been up to. We might think of many Jews that we have read or heard of or perhaps know who have ended up concurring with Paul about this. You know, Cardinal Lustiger comes to mind, of course, or the chief rabbi of Rome, Israel Zoli, who converted under Pius XII, the end of the war. St. Vincent Ferrer, who converted many thousands in Spain, though, of course, his methods are still debated and are the subject of controversy. And then again, that's true of Paul, too. Well, today, the West, the irreligious West, together with the sometimes fanatically religious Muslim world, is certainly in no position to criticize the sins of Christians or their zeal for conversions. In Israel is a scandal not only to Christians from times past, but it's a stumbling block, a scandal on to the secular world as well, and to the Muslim world. Indeed, the zeal on both those quarters is often the zeal of the mob. The advent of a new Jewish state has thrown them into a frenzy. In their hands, the past sins of Christians are repeated and even exacerbated. They seem to be more and more hardened against Jews. Zionism is racism. Join the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, etc., etc. Now, anti-Zionism can be found among Jews too, as I indicated earlier, and sometimes in quite radical forms, as you can see here from these pictures from London. If we're sent into exile, these folks say, we should remain in exile. We have to trust God and wait for HaMashiach. Now, these tend to be fringe sects, to be sure, in Judaism, and not much appreciated by their fellow Jews for the most part. But they're right about this, at least. The main issue here is the faithfulness of the people, wherever they are. Only God can grant possession of the land. But on the other hand, people need a place, and a place needs a government. The Jews are regathering in Israel. Where else should they regather? Israel has adopted a democratic form of government while its people wait for the Messiah. Is that wrong? Is there something wrong with that? Does the state of Israel represent a denial of their special status as the elect people, as the theocratic people, the people whose king is God himself? Or is it a responsible move, blessed by providence, while Jews wait for God? That's a live argument amongst Jews and to some extent amongst Christians. A major piece of this puzzle, of course, is the fact that many Jews are no longer waiting. Their commitment is ethnic and cultural and political, but not religious, which is why some think they are traitors to Jewish culture, which is religious at its core, even its political core, maybe especially its political core. God is king of Israel. how theological can you get? Well, to the one side lies the danger of a new sort of zealotry or Bar Kokhbaism, violent people trying to bring in the kingdom by force, and to the other side lies the danger of a new Sadduceeism, or Saulism, we might say, where the people just want to be like everybody else and leave us alone, thank you very much. Not really interested in what God is doing, but do want some peace in their own place. However you look at it, the state of Israel is at least sometimes a stumbling block to the Jew, as well as a scandal to the Greek or the Arab. Well, perhaps then those who think the whole idea a bad idea are right. Yeah. But God is in charge of all this. He sees the pieces of the puzzle and knows just how to arrange them. He could see them even before they were cut. He knew what was going to happen through Herzl, and he knew all of the other factors that went into the making up of Israel. This oracle from Zechariah testifies that Jerusalem will become a cup of reeling to all the peoples and a heavy stone that they will not be able to roll without injuring themselves. And so it has. God appears not only to have foreseen the present situation, as we would expect, but to be fighting on Israel's side, as even some largely agnostic Jews who have been involved with defending Israel would tell you. God has fought against Israel from time to time because of its apostasy, but now he seems to be fighting for them once again, as, for example, in the Yom Kippur War. Israel as a people requiring a place, still matters to God. God did not disinvest in Israel. He invested everything when he became incarnate in the womb of a Jewish girl. Even when he's, in the language of Revelation 12, snatched Jesus up to the heavenly throne, his own throne, he did not disinvest in Israel. The gospel that is preached in Jesus' name is always a gospel for the Jew first, as Paul says, and then also for the Greek. And we've heard from Jesus that God has unfinished business with the Jews. The prophets all testify to this. I don't know if you've read through the Minor Prophets lately. If not, I would recommend it with this in mind. The nations are going to be gathered to Israel as well as the Israelites are being gathered to Israel. And there's a reason for that. They're drawn there along with the Jews because that is where God will present his Messiah a second time. For Israel, first of all, but not only for Israel, for everyone. God has unfinished business with the nations as well. And it will be finished where it was begun, in Jerusalem. Well, another theological footnote here. By saying such a thing, of course, I am standing athwart, not history, I think, but certainly the modern philosophy of history. This maxim formulated nicely by Troeltsch, although it goes back to Lessing and Kant, really, isolates history from theology and theology from history. Here in Washington, you talk about that as separation of church and state, which is nice if you had some idea what it meant. But Christianity and Judaism, for that matter, cannot do that, cannot isolate history from theology and theology from history. One reason I suspect that Western liberals so hate Israel is, and I don't, sorry, I shouldn't have used the word liberal. I mean, I'm talking about a wide range of people from further left than any of us have ever been to somewhere pretty close to us. one reason I think that so many people hate Israel is that it stubbornly and now alarmingly represents what all modern thinking cannot abide. The knowledge that God acts in history and also acts against history in the sense of the history we're trying to design for ourselves. If we're going to think Christianly about these things, we can't think like Lessing or Kant or Troeltsch, for that matter. We can't even think like Teilhard de Chardin, but I'm not going there at the moment. I'm going to be briefer with this than I'd intended to be because I know we need to go to questions. There's a very interesting essay by Nikolai Berdyaev, which you can read easily enough for yourself online. It's built on an essay from 1912, but the one I have in mind is 1924, and it's called The Jewish Problem as a Christian Problem. And The Jewish Question as a Christian Question. And in it, Berdyaev confronts anti-Semitism in a serious way, and he breaks it down into the sort of ordinary instinctual dislike of Jews, the sort of gut level reaction that many people who are not Jews seem to have, a more ideological type of Judaism, which anti-Semitism rather, which is political anti-Semitism, in which our calculations are all based on what we get out of it, okay? It's all about how the kingdoms of Caesar, the kingdoms of this world, the interests of Caesar line up with our interests, and we move around accordingly, and we're not much interested in a theological people. And deeper still, he says, is racial anti-Semitism, which has its own ideology that, as it turned out, took very powerful form amongst the Nazis, and he more or less predicted that. He didn't predict the Nazis as such, but he said this is growing in Aryan countries, and it's even worse than it is here in Russia. And then fourthly, he talked about the religious type of anti-Semitism. And when he talked about these four types, he said, look, the first three are absolutely verboten to Christians. Christians, you know, cannot indulge in instinctual or political or racial anti-Semitism in any way. But religious anti-Semitism is somehow built into Christianity, he said. Christianity, I quote, in a profound sense, is a religious anti-Semitism, or more accurately stated, anti-Judaism. Thus, whereas these other types are completely impermissible and alien to the religion of love, a religious anti-Judaism enters into the Christian faith as a component part. What does he mean? Well, he means quite simply, I think, that Christianity, in recognizing Jesus as Messiah, cannot be neutral about Jewish rejection of Jesus as Messiah. Now, there are a lot of people today, and this is where I'm going to cut some corners so that we can go to Q&A. There are a lot of people today who think that the best way to, as Berdyaev puts it, to bear our own cross as Christians and help lighten the cross that Jews bear because of their the hardening in part that God has put upon them in their rejection of the Messiah, what that has meant to them down through the centuries as they've been in exile and suffered many persecutions, that's their cross. He says, we need to learn to bear our own cross by being less interested in just our own worldly advantage and more interested in following our Lord, and then at the same time to help them carry their cross while they wrestle with whether he is the Lord. That's the approach that he wants us to take, and I think it's right. Well, there's another approach or there's an approach, as I just mentioned, which thinks that the best way to help lighten their burden or help them carry their cross, so to say, is to return to the notion that, sorry, there's Jerry's book. Let me just see where I need to go here quickly. I'm going to skip this stuff because I'm explaining it to you really quickly right now. There's a movement called post-supersessionism or anti-supersessionism, which says, look, we need to dump this whole idea that Christians are the chosen people of God and the Jews were that, but now the church is everything Israel was. We need to recognize that there are two covenants here, one for Jews and one for Christians. Or there's several variations on that theme. But the idea is allow Jews to be Jews without even suggesting that they should or ought to be Christians. That's a very crude way of putting it, but that's really what it amounts to. And I'm wanting to warn you off that. We can talk about it in the Q&A, because I think it is a defection from the gospel. Either Jesus is Israel's Messiah or he's not. If he's not Israel's Messiah, he's nobody's Messiah. So I don't know how you can lighten the load of Jews by sort of relieving them of the burden of hearing the gospel. It seems to me what you do instead is you relieve yourselves of the gospel. And I'm certainly not wanting to recommend that. So just forgive me while I move to this and wrap up so that we can go to questions. In trying to say in short compass what I think we ought to say in answer to this sort of question which you've put to me, I want to start quickly with the land and with the city at its heart, Jerusalem, and to say that the land matters because it's the land from which Jews were exiled, to which God has permitted them to return, and it's the place of promise. The city matters, and we can go into whether we do the capital thing or not, but the city matters because it's the city of the great king. It's the place God has chosen to establish his throne and to make his dwelling. It's the place where Jesus was crucified, raised on a very human throne, so to say. And it is the place where he will complete his unfinished business with Israel and at the same time with every race and nation of man when he returns in triumph to judge the living and the dead. All these tombs, Jewish tombs, Christian tombs, Muslim tombs, lined up outside the city, they're all a testament to that. This is the place where God will do justice finally, and do it even to the dead. The people must gather. They need a place to gather. This is the place, and no other place will do. Why? Because they are being gathered precisely to and for the Messiah, to and for his salvation and his judgment. This salvation and this judgment is not merely spiritual or ideational. It's historical. It's incarnate. It involves a real person judging, Jesus of Nazareth. And there's a place where the judgment will be located. So no one's going to argue with me, I think, that the people of Israel matter. I'm also saying that the land of Israel and the city of Jerusalem matter just as much, and they matter because of the people. Here is the key theater of the war between good and evil. Here is the key theater in the war between truth and error that is being fought in history. We should not be surprised that the children of Israel who are not yet in the church are gathering here. We should not be surprised that this gathering requires a state and an army and needs to wrestle with questions like the capital. or rather that they force us to wrestle with it. We should not be surprised that these things are happening. The prophets have predicted them, and we need to reckon with them. Christians should pray for forgiveness where they themselves have resisted this people and their right desires to be in their own land. And they should do that with their leaders, I think, not only in this very symbolic way that John Paul II undertook, but they should do it on a regular and indeed a daily basis, praying that Israel and its inhabitants be given that spirit of compassion and supplication that Zechariah talked about, so that despite the violence that has been done to them, and yes, despite the violence that they themselves in ungodly fashions are doing to those around them, that they may learn to look to him whom they have pierced and be ready to say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." If our Lord is indeed the son of Mary, the Jewish girl, whom we bless as the Queen of Heaven, yes. Do you think that Jesus or Mary are uninterested in the place from which they came? How could they be? St. Thomas Aquinas, I can't stop without quoting Thomas, can I? Suggests to us in his commentary on Romans that the shoe is someday going to be on the other foot. I quote, "Gentiles are the believers who will grow lukewarm or will fall away entirely, being deceived by Antichrist. These will be restored to their primitive fervor after the conversion of the Jews." It's the Jewish people coming back to God in the sense of recognizing what God has already done for them in the person of Jesus, that will reinvigorate an apostate church, never mind an apostate civilization like the one we live in. So, I will leave it there, although I could spend the next half hour easily explaining this painting to you. And we may get to that, but we'd better go to questions.
My name is Tori Bauckham. I'm pastor at Truro Anglican Church. It wasn't clear to me whether you're saying supersessionism is a good thing or not.
I'm saying, yeah, thank you for that. That's helpful. Because I had to skip through that section, it's no surprise that it's not clear to you. And yes. The kind of supersessionism that says God is done with Jews, thank you very much, is also the kind that leads not only to practical anti-Semitism on all sorts of levels, but leads to a complete rejection of any consideration of the land of Israel as having any importance whatsoever. That kind of supersessionism is simply flat-out heterodoxy. It's been held and acted on by many people at many times, and still is today, but it has no warrant whatsoever in either the scriptures or the traditions. The Church of Jesus Christ is not something that supersedes the election of Israel. It's something that fulfills the election of Israel. So that's the one side. The flip side of the coin is this. In fulfilling Israel's covenant with God, the covenant itself is transformed. Just as in fulfilling the covenant with God, Jesus is transformed. He is crucified. He's dead and buried. he's also resurrected and ascends into heaven where he sits at God's right hand. And I, you know, if you think I'm handling that too literally, well, you'll discover there's a lot more to it if you look at my books on the subject, so we'll leave that. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that you can't do without some form of supersessionism. There are not multiple covenants that God has and continues to have. He has called Abraham, and through Abraham has made a covenant with the descendants of Abraham. And as Paul makes clear, Gentiles can now be included, though they're not genetically included. They can be spiritually and politically and religiously and soteriologically and eschatologically included. And that's the church. It's Jew and Gentile as one new man. So whereas I'm against any kind of harsh, punitive, absolute supersessionism, I'm also against, if you like, I'm against the kind of anti-supersessionism that says, no, you know, God's covenant with the Jews through Moses, that just carries on untouched, more or less, by Jesus. And then Christians have this Jesus covenant over here. Paul would shave his head like me at such a thought. The case is rather this. The covenant that God made with the Jews through Abraham and fulfilled through the ministries of Moses and Aaron and David, partially fulfilled, he absolutely fulfilled in the priest king, the Messiah, Jesus. And as a result, the covenant itself is transformed in Jesus. And Jew and Gentile enter into the blessings of God through that transformation that takes place in baptism and in communion with Jesus and takes place in the Eucharistic transformation and will take place ultimately in the resurrection of the dead and their judgment and their salvation if they're judged to belong to that. And that's for Jew and Greek both, as Paul clearly says. So no to harsh supersessionism, no to the idea that the Jews have no more place in God's purposes except maybe as a whipping boy of some kind. Absolute no to that. There's not a shred of support for that in the scriptures or in the tradition in terms of the magisterial tradition. But at the same time, no to the idea that what Jesus does simply affects Christians and not Jews. That also is completely untenable from a Christian point of view.
Well, this seems like a very important question that the church is still struggling with, and I just want to kind of respond this way. It seems like the mistake of the first century was to believe that you had to be a member of the first covenant in order to be a member of the second covenant, the new covenant. Judaizers. Then 20 centuries, we repaid that error, that saying that the first covenant is actually null and void. So it seems to me we have a mystery here between God's purposes for the Jews still abiding, and Jesus is their Messiah.
Yeah, so I would recommend to you, if I may, in the brand new issue of Nova et Vetera, the English edition, 16.3, if I'm not mistaken, this summer, just out a couple of weeks ago. There's an article there, a couple of articles on the problem. One of them is mine. It's called Jew and Gentile in the Church Today or something like that. I forget. I would recommend that you read that, and you'll see how I'm approaching that. If you want something more detailed, there's a very long chapter on it in Theological Negotiations, which appears in November, a book from Baker Academic Press that I've written, and there's a long chapter called To the Jew First.